The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. This year, 2024, is an election year in America, a presidential election year. And so we will be doing two podcasts a week rather than our usual one, because we want to and because we know you can't get enough Americano in your life. I am delighted to be joined today by Richard Hanania, who is an American political science researcher, according to Wikipedia. I'm sorry to cite Wikipedia at you, Richard. You are also the founder and president of the think tank, the Center for the Study of Partisanship and Ideology, CSPI. And you write an extremely interesting and, to use an overused word, eclectic substack about all sorts of things. And the obvious thing to start talking to you about would be Sydney Sweeney's breasts, because you've caused quite a stir by suggesting that those two magnificent weapons have destroyed wokeness. I think you did a tweet about that. How many views did you get on that tweet?
I got about 62 million at this point. There was another one that got 20 million, so not as high performing. But yes, obviously there's quite an interest in this topic. And look, sometimes the lowest effort tweets sometimes get you the most attention. So somebody said it to me. I just said, wokeness is dead. That's the entirety of the text, along with a video of her looking fabulous on Saturday Night Live for 30 seconds or so. But I did write a follow-up article saying, yes, Sydney Sweeney's boobs are anti-woke. And the point I was making, to the extent that I had a point and it wasn't just trolling, there was a serious point under it, is that it's never been true that women's appearance and behavior is irrelevant to the culture wars. In a lot of ways, this is central to the culture wars. So the modern culture wars is often traced back to Gamergate that started in 2014. That was basically maybe the number one issue in that was women in video games, you know, showing too much breast and too much of their behinds. And this was dehumanizing them or objectifying them. And there were many people who wanted that in the video game industry to change. And so to the extent that these things do matter, and conservatives usually support traditional sort of markers of beauty, especially the parts of the woman's body that, you know, putting aside sort of Christian conservatives, traditionalists who want women to cover up. I think that that's the debate 20, 30 years ago. Those people were fighting with a more libertarian left. Today, the division in the culture wars is people comfortable with sexuality, sexualizing women, and those who are largely uncomfortable with. So yes, Sydney Sweeney's boobs didn't end wokeness, but they are relevant to our debates.
I think you said in that piece that they are evidence that we are past peak wokeness, perhaps.
I think that's right. But I think even the bigger thing about peak wokeness is Sydney Sweeney went to her mom's birthday party, and it turned out that they were all MAGAs. They were wearing red hats that said Make 60 Great Again. And her dad had that like Blue Lives Matter flag police shirt. And this was like a story for like 24 hours. She didn't apologize. She said, don't jump to any conclusions about our politics. She didn't even denounce them and say, I'm going to give all my money to BLM right now. I mean, that's what would have happened in 2020 or 2021. Yes. I think that's probably the better indication. She was just later just went home. Hosted Saturday Night Live and nobody cares. I think that means that we're probably past the worst moment of this.
Can I ask, before we get on to what I really want to talk about, which is whether America is in decline or not, can I ask whether Gamergate, which you just referred to there, was that the moment in your life where you became most politically conscious?
No, I've been politically conscious since my early 20s. So, you know, early 2000s, really 9/11, the Iraq War. I was thinking about politics before then. I was on university campuses. I mean, I was in law school and I was thinking a lot about sort of what I was seeing on college campuses. That was the early days of controversies over Halloween costumes and such. So, no, Gamergate wasn't sort of formative for me. I'm a little bit older than that.
I'm patronizing you unacceptably. But let's talk about American decline, because, I mean, it seems to be a lot of people on the right, there's a natural tendency in America, and it's a transatlantic phenomenon too, to assume that Western civilization is in decline. And it seems to me, I can't claim to have a very profound understanding of your thought, but it seems to me that you are resisting that idea at the moment. And that particularly if you look at the war in Ukraine you are bucking the trend of thinkers on the right who are leaning towards a sort of a view of democracy that is pessimistic. Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah, I mean, American society, I mean, you have to ask always compared to what? I mean, there's many things to be disappointed in American society and Western societies more generally. But compared to what is the question? So in 2022, I wrote a piece called The Year of Fukuyama, and two big things happened in 2022. There was Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and now Russia's a little bit, the momentum is with them. But at the time, people thought Russia would just dominate Ukraine, right? Russia would just take Kiev. Russia would be the rulers of Ukraine or have a puppet regime installed. That's what people thought when the war was launched. Now Russia might take some, you know, land in the east, but I mean, compared to what the expectations were, Ukraine is the vast majority where the vast majority of the population is. It's going to lean towards the west. If Russia dominates them militarily, they're going to hate Russia forever. It's not a an ideological win there. It's just a brute force kind of thing. And then also in 2022 was China was continuing zero COVID. And so, you know, at the beginning, zero COVID was like, okay. I mean, it looked like they were doing a good job because they'd actually stamped it out. We in the West were still doing lockdowns and masks, and people were doing articles about how China life had basically gotten to normal. So you could at least say those methods work. Eventually it broke down and they were still doing zero COVID and like locking entire like sections of cities off after there was a vaccine, after it was clear that like you can get COVID and go on with your life, and the West had moved on. And then a lot of other things were going on in China too. At the time, they were turning sort of away from the model of economic growth that had made them successful. Really, the state was getting more involved in the market. And so economic growth has stalled since then. And so that I said 2022 was the year of Fukuyama because, I mean, these two great sort of challenges to Western civilization really had sort of proved themselves flawed. I think the last few years have backed this up. I mean, the U.S. growth continues to surprise people. I don't think that China or Russia have become any more appealing to the rest of the world as sort of ideological models. And so decline has to be sort of relative, and there really isn't a challenge to the West at this point in time.
But great civilizations tend to commit suicide, I think people say that, don't they, rather than being killed by autocracies. And do you not see in, even just in the gloom about America at the moment, you talk about the economy, yes, all the macro indicators are good, but Americans feel very gloomy about the economy, and that's supposed to be one of the reasons why Donald Trump might win the election. Do you think that Americans are fulfilling this wish fulfillment, in a sense? They want to be in decline.
Yeah, I think there is a general, I don't know if it's wish fulfillment, but there is a just a negativity bias. So a lot of people who look at the data say, look at what's happening to absolute poverty in the world, China and India, you know, absolute poverty is going down the line. Any indicators you want to look in the what's going on in the world, that usually things are getting better depending on what you're looking at. But there is just this sort of, you know, pessimistic kind of, I think it's probably more to do with communications technology than objective conditions. I mean, I think that social media has made young people crazy. I mean, you see these things. I mean, they just make no sense. Like, oh, you're in 20, you know, who would want to bring, you know, we can't have a low birth rate. Who wants to bring children to the world with global warming? And it's like people reproduced during World War II and the Great Depression and old European religious wars that killed large fractions of the population. I mean, it's pretty ridiculous. So it seems like our lives have been getting better. At the same time, we've become more sort of fragile and pessimistic and irrational. I hope we adjust to that. I hope that's just like, okay, social media really only took off around 2005, 2010. We were flooded with this sort of negativity and these addictive devices that made us crazy. Maybe laws and institutions and norms start to direct us away from that in the next several years. I'm hoping for that. But yes, I agree that there is a pessimistic mood in society. Although I'll say that people, individuals, like how happy people are in their individual lives, other than what's going on with young girls, it's not as pessimistic about the global macro. If you ask people, how's Congress doing? How's the country doing? People are very pessimistic because of the bias the news getting. I don't think Americans are walking around miserable all the time. That's at least not my impression from the country.
Yes. But perhaps the sense that America can be a force for good in the world has gone.
You know, it waxes and wanes. I think during the Ukraine, you know, right when the Ukraine war happened, there was a resurgence. We have a pretty low attention span. So these things can wax and wane depending on what's going on in the news. Then Ukraine started not doing so well, and people now think the Ukraine's war is hopeless. Israel, right after October 7th, had all the support. Everyone was like, we love Israel. Now, global opinion is to a large extent turning against it. So a lot of these things, I think, are just responding to news cycles. I don't know if there's like a long-term sort of There probably is. I mean, just the fact that, you know, from when I was growing up, the 1990s, it was probably more universally positive. You didn't see these conspiracy theories like, you know, on the right, you'll see, oh, they just want to make Eastern Europe gay or whatever like that. I mean, we didn't have those theories back then. And there's much more of that than there used to be. But it could really, I think, shift pretty quickly depending on events.
And as for interventionism, nobody really is talking about direct military intervention in Ukraine. Certainly there wouldn't be in the Middle East anymore. That is something that has shifted in American politics away from a belief that America can fix the world and be a policeman.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there was something called the Vietnam syndrome, that after Vietnam, the U.S. wouldn't have large ground troops in foreign countries that were far away. And we really stuck to that, except there was one anomaly, and that was the 19 months or so after September 11th, where the country was just in a foul mood, and we went into Iraq and we went into Afghanistan. But if you take out that, you know, the 19-month period after 9/11, we've really stuck to the sort of the lessons of Vietnam, and we haven't done a lot of ground troops. I think people saw it, just because Iraq and Afghanistan lasted a very long time, and we didn't leave once we went in there. Notice we did not go into and send ground troops anymore. We bombed Libya from the skies, and we've done interventions like that. But yeah, I think that the U.S. really hasn't, since Vietnam, hasn't really been into sending large-scale forces to take risks in foreign countries. Iraq and Afghanistan are exceptions, and I think we're just reverting to that post-Vietnam norm.
And Afghanistan, I think you discovered the story on this. I may be wrong, but Afghanistan, there was some extraordinary attempts at cultural colonialism in Afghanistan and attempts by the State Department to sort of turn Afghan society into a kind of woke LGBTQ accepting place. But that was you that broke that story. I'm right about that.
Yeah, well, I relied on the documents that the Washington Post brought out. Wrote about it, right?
Yeah, I read you on it first, I think is what I mean, yeah.
Yeah, so there was that. You're right. I think it's like some people can make too much out of that, and you'll get people who are like, the whole thing is just about cultural imperialism or making, you know, bringing LGBT and women. But I don't think that that's what's going on at the highest levels of the presidential administrations. But I do think that there was just this sort of, and maybe we're moving a little bit away from that, this unthinking idea that, like, okay, you're just going to bring all good things at once, and all good things, you hire these consultants and these academics, and of course good things include LGBT and women. Just people bringing this to attention and sort of noticing it, and people were started to see, hey, wait, these things are controversial even at home. So I think the Trump administration was doing a lot less of that stuff than the Bush administration did, even though the people at the top weren't necessarily more friendly to gay rights in the Bush administration. They really just weren't paying attention to that stuff. So yeah, I mean, I think it's more of a, I don't think it's central to American foreign policy, but I think it's just an unthinking assumption that goes into sort of everything the U.S. does. And I think that's becoming more, it used to be bipartisan, but I think it's now just mostly in Democratic administrations.
And do you think America is losing its clout as an international player? It is still the, you know, the supreme military force in the world. But if you look at what's going on in Gaza at the moment, America's ability to shape events seems to be less potent.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, we spent a decade plus in Vietnam and weren't able to keep the government in power there that we wanted. So I don't know how much, you know, it's hard to measure our ability to shape events. I think that we are a divided country, so there isn't like one American outlook on a lot of these issues. So for example, though, you brought up the war in Gaza, the Biden administration cares a lot about protecting civilian casualties in Gaza. The Trump administration, if they come into office, I think that's going to be much less of a concern. So it's like, if there's, you know, if the Trump administration is in power, the American goal is probably going to be Israel wins. With the Biden administration, I think it's something like just stopping the war and having a two-state solution. So obviously, it's harder to influence events when you're this divided.
And one question that's often asked is, when did America last win a war? When do you think America last won a war?
We won Libya. I mean, we got rid of the goal was we got rid of the guy. I mean, and he was dead and we lost no troops at all. So, I mean, it depends on really how you define these things. You know, Ukraine, was it a win or a loss? Well, I mean, compared to what people thought would happen, I think that, you know, Russia did much, much worse than people thought would happen. But obviously, Russia has gained some territory and might gain some more. You know, it's hard to say these sort of definitional things. It's hard to capture in a single term, you know, one win or loss.
We had an article in the magazine this week about TikTok and the move to ban it, or not ban it, but force the sale of it to a US entity and so on. And that story touches on a great paranoia in America, which is that China and Russia are successfully stoking up, using tech, are successfully stoking up the culture wars, are making America weaker, more divided, and so on. What do you think about all that?
I think there's a couple things there. I think the idea that Russia or China, I mean, America is so intellectually, sort of culturally dominant across much of the world. And you want to compare like America soft power in China versus China soft power in America. I mean, there's really no comparison. Obviously, Chinese people know a lot more about American culture than vice versa. I mean, some of these Chinese propaganda efforts, I mean, they're just laughable when you sort of see them. Russia, I think, actually has succeeded quite a bit in sort of shifting the right-wing narrative towards the Russian perspective on things like Ukraine. Part of that is they played up the culture war that was already there. The idea that, you know, they were deeply divided on things like LGBT and the role of women and minorities and so forth. And Russia was able to sort of successfully play into that. And so when there's a sort of an opening in that way, they can definitely take advantage of it. And then, with the TikTok thing, I think it's more theoretical than, I don't see direct evidence that China is shaping the TikTok algorithm or directly controlling the company at this point. But I think that people see that it's a theoretical possibility in the case of war or something, they would, push a line on a specific issue. I think that's a legitimate concern and something that, the government is thinking about carefully.
There was concern that, during Black Lives Matter and so on, that China was kind of fostering wokeness. They were sponsoring, Huawei was sponsoring Black Lives Matter events and so on, that China sees in America's cultural agonies, sees opportunity.
Yeah, I saw some of those articles. I didn't find them very convincing. It's like this one organization in the Bay Area had something to do with something in China. I mean, we've had these urban race riots in the United States going back to the late 60s, early 70s. If China was responsible for 0.01%, if you told me 0.01% of, the BLM craziness of 2020, I'd probably guess that was an overestimate. I have no doubt they'd like to do stuff like that, but I just think it's a drop in the ocean.
So you don't think, taking out China and Russia's role in it, you don't think wokeness is a kind of suicidal instinct in the West?
I think that wokeness is a major problem. I think it hurts Western civilization. It's hard to sort of say because some people think wokeness distracts people from economic leftism. And I tend to think that economic leftism is probably more harmful to the West long term. Like, look, you can announce your pronouns and you can have a few quotas, or you can increase your tax burden by 20-30%, kill regulation and growth. And so the net effect of wokeness is sort of hard to actually measure. And so, yeah, I think I wrote a book called The Origins of Woke, and I write a lot about woke and where it comes from and why it's important. But I tend to think that it's maybe not as important as some people think.
You talk about economic leftism there. Do you think that in a couple of election cycles' time, America might have a seriously left-wing Democratic Party?
I think we have already a seriously, very left-wing Democratic Party. I think that the Biden administration compared to the Obama administration, I mean, it's very weird because people judge these things based on like what the guy at the top looks like. And people thought Obama, they tended to treat Obama like he was more left-wing than Biden. But, whatever Biden thinks at its heart, I think his administration's policies have been far to the left of Obama. And I think we're sort of there already. But at the same time, we have a more right-wing Republican Party. Polarization, is the story here. How that actually plays out will be sort of interesting to see.
How is Biden's administration more left-wing economically?
If you look at just the scale of the stimulus bills and the spending bills, it's on a completely different level. You look at what they're doing with the National Labor Relations Board. Biden's the first president to go to actually a picket line and just embrace organized labor in this way. And so a lot of the climate goals, a lot of the policies are to the left of Obama. I don't know if Obama would have, he might have wanted to do this, he might have felt more restrained at the time. But definitely the center of gravity has shifted in the Democratic Party.
So in terms of spending, if not yet in terms of taxing?
Well, taxes, I mean, he needs Congress to go along with that. He can't unilaterally raise the tax rate.
Yeah, but he hasn't really pushed to do it. I mean, despite making noises about it, he hasn't really pushed to...
Well, he can't. I mean, the Republicans control the House and they'll never go for a tax increase. And so that's hard to measure that. But yeah, the stuff that the president controls and the Democratic Party, what they vote for, I think it's clearly been to the left of Obama.
Yes. And what other aspects of American decline? What makes you feel that America is in decline?
The fertility issue, I think, is huge. I mean, we were sort of exceptional with that regard up until, 5 or 10 years ago. We were ahead of Europe and we thought that maybe we had this thing figured out. But now we look more and more like a European country. I mean, I think the mental health problems of young people, this is bad. I mean, you look at the numbers. I mean, they're just sort of, you almost have to look away because they're just so terrible how screwed up these kids are. And I think a lot of it comes from sort of, I read Abigail Schreier's recent book, Bad Therapy. And I think that a lot of it is the focus on mental health. It sort of created a sort of navel gazing and helplessness in the culture of young people. So I think this is probably a problem. I think the economic leftism, yeah, on the policy level, I think that there's an entitlement crisis coming up. So in 10 years, and I've talked to some people about this on my own podcast at CSPI, we're going to choose between continuing to fund the Social Security and Medicare. As the population gets older, we're just going to shovel more money to old people. We're going to have to either cut those benefits, or we're going to have to raise taxes massively because the budget doesn't work out. And I hope we cut these programs before we do the tax increases. So those are the things that I'm looking at.
And does America have to be an extremely high migrant level, immigrant level society to cope with the problems that are coming down the line when you talk about fertility and you talk about an aging population?
Doesn't necessarily have to. I think in many ways, immigration helps. You know, you're just helping with the age pyramid. You're helping with economic dynamism. You look at the number of major companies that are highly successful that are funded with immigrants. I mean, they're off the charts. They're a huge percentage of them. And so, yeah, I think immigration is one of America's strengths. I think at the same time, a lot of the dangers of immigration that people were warning about. 10, 15 years ago, I used to read books by people like Pat Buchanan, and they would argue that there would be a separatist movement in the American Southwest as it became Hispanic. People will want to break away. California and Arizona enjoyed nothing. I live in California. Nothing close to that has happened. I mean, assimilation has worked pretty well. And so, yeah, I think immigration is one of our strengths.
And this is something you've changed on yourself a lot because you've got in trouble recently. People have tried to suggest that you were a white supremacist because you wrote a lot about race as a younger man. And I think you are interested in hereditarianism. Is that, that's fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, there is a science of heredity. I mean, there is, things like intelligence and other personality traits are inherited. Now, that doesn't mean that certain people are worthless or don't have anything to contribute to society. I think that that's taking that in a negative direction and sort of understanding markets and the division of labor and how people can contribute if we get our institutions right. I think that's where the focus needs to be.
Yes. You say you think immigration is a force for dynamism, I think you said. Do you think current levels of immigration are working against that?
You know, I don't see it. I mean, if there was something we saw, like, you know, you'd have to look at sort of data, right? So if the economy was doing poorly, for example, no, low-wage workers especially have been gaining in the last few years. You could look at people worry about immigrant crime. Immigrants turned out not to commit crime. The crime rate did go up in the last few years, but it's urban areas that were subject to these, you know, protests against the police and so forth. That's where it's coming from. And so, you know, I'm open to the indication that we could be going at a too fast of a rate. I think it just sort of looks disorganized and looks sort of scary to people to see so many people crossing the border. But whether it's objectively a problem beyond the political rancor it causes, yeah, I don't know. I'm looking sort of still looking for the evidence of that.
You seem to be patriotic. Would you accept you're patriotic?
I think my sensibilities in this are probably more liberal. I'm sort of a universalist. I just think America has been sort of a good force for classical liberal ideals. And I think it's good to be patriotic in that sense, and that America is just a force for good in the world and good for humanity.
But the word nationalism has gone from being kind of unacceptable not so long ago in large parts of society to being a sort of thing that people talk about seriously now. And, you know, people used to distinguish between patriotism and nationalism quite a lot. I think they do so less now. Do you regard yourself as a nationalist?
So these words, I mean, they just, you have to look at sort of how people use them. Most people who call themselves nationalist, I tend not to agree with on the specifics of policy. Like, look, I mean, if you want to have a co-centric idea of sympathy and say, I put my own nation first, that's one thing. But often their ideas are very bad. Like they think that cutting off trade and stopping automation and stopping technological progress, when someone calls themselves a nationalist, they're never like, I need to go out and cure cancer. Like we have to have a national thing. We just got to cure cancer and we got to cure aging. And we got to give those benefits to America first. It's like, no, they're focused on the borders. They're focused on trade. They have this sort of zero-sum mentality often, where doing good for your nation has to somehow involve maybe not doing something bad to other countries, but at least not interacting with them as much. Like, our country is declining because we're giving too much money to Ukraine or something like that. So nationalists tend to think in these zero-sum terms. You know, I'm fine with someone thinking America is sort of, you know, very important for the world and wanting the best for America and even caring about it more than other nations. I just think that it has to be approached in a smart and reasonable way. And so, yeah, I mean, I'd probably say no, just because, you know, I disagree with most people who call themselves nationalists these days, but I am nationalistic in a sense.
And I mean, economically, it seems to me on left and right, there's a growing consensus about tariffs and protecting the economy, and more of an industrial policy, nationalist economic policy. And that seems to be happening all over the West. Do you go along with that? Do you think that, or do you think that's actually a dangerous shift away from American ideals?
Yeah, look, the U.S. has problems. I pointed to wokeness and I pointed to sort of mental health of the youth and some other things. Our economy is not the problem. I mean, there's nothing in the data to suggest that. So what we've been doing compared to China or Russia, but you can compare it to Europe, our closest sort of peer competitors, it's been working. And so I think that people feel like they have to have it integrated. Like, if America is doing badly culturally, it must be the economy is also bad. Or if it's doing bad economically, the culture. They think these things are sort of intertwined, while I tend to sort of separate these things. And I could say, look, American economics, our free market, our, you know, our open trade policy has generally been working. Some things culturally we've been doing have not been working. And I make that distinction. So yeah, I'm not a big fan of this kind of a turn towards economic nationalism.
Do you think perhaps though America is dying of affluence? I mean, you talk about fertility and you talk about mental health there. Those are two areas where perhaps affluence and the strength of the American economy is working against Americans.
Yeah, so it's sort of the opposite of what the economic nationalists are saying. It's not that our policies have failed. It's that they're perhaps too successful. Now, what you could do with that information, you can't say, well, I want to, I mean, some people do say that, you know, I would like a poorer country. I mean, you'll never win over the public and people will not be happy with that. And people want to improve their lives. I don't think the answer can be we should try to make living standards decline or something like that. And by the way, I mean, like the countries that have, I don't know if actually it is a problem of affluence, because you look at countries in like Southern and Eastern Europe, they're much poorer than the United States. If we went down to the GDP of Italy or Spain, I mean, those countries have lower birth rates. They have a lot of similar problems, maybe not specifically in the exact same way, but I think the fertility one is big. And, you know, Southern and Eastern Europe are as bad or worse than the US and Western Europe. And so I tend to think these things interact in complicated ways. It's hard to predict or understand. We should try to build a healthier culture. We should try to build a healthier economy and not sort of think that we can sort of predict what's going to make, you know, how one is going to influence the other.
Richard and Aina, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. Thank you very much for coming on to Americano. And perhaps next time we'll do a full hour on Sydney Sweeney.
Would be my pleasure. I'll bring pics.
Please do. That's it for that episode of the Americano podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. I'd like to thank our brilliant Spectator production team, Natasha Farrows, my producer, Oscar Edmondson, who's sitting opposite me. And I would like to ask any listeners who have ideas as to who they think I should get on the podcast. We're going to be doing two a week, so we have to come up with plenty of ideas this year. And often you have much better ideas than I do. So please do get in touch if you have an idea of a guest that you think we should try and get on the show, or a subject that you think we haven't covered that we should be covering. And please email that to podcast@spectator.co.uk, or you can get in touch with me directly on Twitter. I think my handle is FreddieGray31, which is depressingly how old I was when I set up my Twitter account. Okay, please do that. Goodbye.